We now begin a very important section on psychiatric diagnosis. That means we're talking about the DSM-IV, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, 4th edition. The DSM-IV is a psychiatric Bible, and it is an excellent source of USMLE questions. You see, the DSM-IV works by laying out what are the clear criterion by which we diagnose different disorders. It gives you a list of symptoms and says the patient must have all of these, or 4 of the following 5, or 7 of the following 8. So there's a clear list of criterion for what makes the diagnosis. This makes a psychiatric diagnosis very reliable, but it also means they don't really have to write the case for the question. It's already been written for them in the criterion. All they need to do is write some fluff around the case and lay out what are the key differential diagnoses that are often confused for that particular diagnostic profile. We're now going to spend some time talking through selected DSM-IV diagnoses. Some of these are more likely to be tested, some of these are less likely to be tested. I'll try to make that clear as we go forward. We're going to start with one that has a fairly high probability, mental retardation. Mental retardation, you might recall, is scored on axis 2. It's one of the two things on axis 2. Let's do a little quick review with things we've talked about before. What is the leading known cause of mental retardation? Well, that's fetal alcohol syndrome. Downs, fragile X, those have, although they're still common, those have a little bit lower incidence. The core part to this section on mental retardation is given in this table. This table lays out for you the levels of mental retardation, mild to profound, the corresponding IQ ranges, and the level of functioning that we associate with each of these levels. This is a table you need to memorize. When given somebody's IQ or level, you should be able to have a pretty good picture about what level of functioning they are or are not capable of. Similarly, given a description of somebody's functioning, you should be able to approximate what is their IQ or what is the appropriate level. Now, although we do use IQ on this table, as mentioned previously, we never diagnose mental retardation just based on IQ. It is an important part of the diagnosis, but we're looking at general functioning as well as the actual measured IQ number. Let's begin with mild retardation. Mildly retarded individuals, we're talking about IQ between 70 and 50. These people are self-supporting with some guidance. They get through life, they can take care of themselves, they just need some help with the more difficult things that come up in life. 85% of the mentally retarded, by far the lion's share, occur within this group. When you hear the phrase mentally retarded, this is what you should be thinking of. In this class, twice as likely to be male by about, again, 2-to-1 ratio. And usually first diagnosed in the first year of school. That is, you need the contrast with peers in close proximity in order to really detect the level of mental retardation. If you've ever seen the old show L.A. Law, in that show there was a guy, an actor, who played a mailroom boy named Benny. Benny was a mentally retarded, a mildly retarded individual. If you can remember that image, you have a good picture for mild retardation. Moderate retardation, IQ 49 to 35. These are people we used to call, in the old lexicon, trainable. That means they benefit from vocational training, but they need some guidance and they need some help so as to not have to deal with some of the real stresses and strains of life. You find them doing work, productive paid labor, but in so-called sheltered workshop situations. Goodwill Industries would be a good example, where they might do assembly work or wrapping and packaging work. Yes, they can do productive labor, but in a more benign setting than a typical factory floor. Severely retarded individuals, we're talking about IQ of 34 to 20. Here, basic vocational training is not helpful. What we can do, however, is teach these severely retarded individuals to do basic self-maintenance habits. What we mean is, you know, brush your teeth, get dressed in the morning, put the toilet seat down when you're done, basic skills. And finally, profoundly retarded. Profoundly retarded, we're talking about IQ below 20, as the name suggests, profound retardation. This is furthest out on the IQ curve and, not surprisingly, the smallest group of the mentally retarded. Profoundly retarded individuals need highly structured environment, constant, often 24-hour nursing care and supervision. Again, when given a description of somebody's level of functioning, you should have a pretty clear sense about what their label and what level of IQ is we're talking about. Next, we want to talk about pervasive developmental disorders, sometimes written as simply PDD. Our representative in this category is autism. If you think the answer to your test question is autism and you look down at the options, sometimes you will not see autism. You'll simply see the overarching category, pervasive developmental disorder, treated as a synonym in that context. Autism is usually only diagnosed in infancy, usually at about 30 months of age. You'll see why in just a second. Autistic individuals have serious problems with reciprocal social interaction. They like the world around them kept just the same. They focus on doing the same activities often over and over again. Language development is abnormal, grossly delayed, or even absent. And they have difficulty not only with verbal, but also nonverbal communication and interaction. One of the key things for diagnosing autism is a failure to ever have separation anxiety. This is why we diagnose it usually when we're talking about 30 months of age. Autistic individuals, in severe forms anyhow, are oblivious to the external world. They don't respond to things in the environment. Or, alternatively, they get very agitated when simple minor peripheral things in the environment are changed. Failure to assume anticipatory posture means when I go to hug a mentally retarded individual, what happens? Well, they hold their arms up as if to join in the embrace. When I go to hug an autistic individual, they show no response, no reaction, simply standing there, sitting there, perhaps self-stimulating. Pronoun reversal? Well, it means when I mean me, I say you, and when I mean you, I say me. It's the reversal of the referent. There's a preference for inanimate objects, so much so that autistic individuals seem to treat people as if they're inanimate objects. There's a failure to appreciate people as somehow unique from the other objects in the world. Male to female ratio, yeah, about 4 to 1, much more likely in boys than in girls. Linked to chromosome abnormality, yes. Chromosome number 15, increasing evidence for this as a source of the dysfunction. Now, this last point on the slide is critical. 80% of autistic individuals are in the mentally retarded range as well. So if you have an autistic individual, the chart is likely to read axis 1, autism, axis 2, mental retardation. There are some exceptions. If you look at the number, clearly there are some autistic individuals who are not mentally retarded, but in general, there's a fairly high correlation. Let's try to get you to call to mind an autistic individual you might have seen portrayed in the press or the media. In the movie Rain Man, you see that movie? The Dustin Hoffman character, Raymond, is played as an autistic adult. Work with me here. What do you think is the IQ of Raymond in that movie? Would you say over 100 or under 100? Well, under 100. I'll answer that for you. Would you say over 70 or under 70? Well, under 70. I'll answer that for you too. Ask yourself, was he self-supporting with some guidance? He could live on his own, take care of himself. He just needed some little help. No. The point of the movie was he didn't have that capacity. Could he learn basic self-maintenance? Could he learn basic productive habits, work in a sheltered workshop situation, do assembly line packaging? No, he couldn't even master that. If you wanted my estimate, I'd have him at about a 35, just able to do basic self-maintenance habits. Now, wait a minute. Didn't he have that wonderful skill of being able to count the toothpicks when they're scattered or count the cards at Vegas and win all that money for his brother? Yes, he did. But that's one skill. He's deficient in a whole host of others. Think about it this way. Remember, IQ is an estimate of the capacity of the glass. Suppose the glass has one really high side and it's low everywhere else. Well, then it doesn't really hold much water, does it? The character he played is called in the old lexicon an idiot savant. Idiot is an old line word for mental retardation. I take you through that exercise as a way to get you to practice identifying somebody's level of retardation based on the functioning. Potential causes. In addition to the chromosome abnormality, or probably associated with it, we find an association with prenatal and perinatal injury for people that end up with autism. Rubella, especially in the first trimester, is particularly associated with autism. What's the mechanism for autism? Well, it's not absolutely clear, but we think we have identified a reasonable hypothesis. It's the failure of apoptosis, apoptosis in the brain. You see, the job of your brain, as mentioned before, is to change its shape, its structure, its interconnectedness to make you responsive to the world you find yourself in. Early in life, that is most important, but it continues all through your life. Ask yourself, what would you be like if that process did not happen? What if that modification of those connections, your circuitry, to be responsive to the world did not take place? Well, you'd be autistic. Think of the symptoms of autism. They're like the world left just the way it is. They don't develop the sense that people are different than the rest of the world. There's a failure to anticipate and understand language as a different set of issues. It's a failure of apoptosis. And for that reason, the treatment for autism is focused on behavioral techniques. You're going underneath, that is, you're bypassing the cortical pathology and getting the behavioral change at the subcortical level. On the internet, if you look, you may find people singing the praises of secretin and vitamin B6 as interventions that will help autistic individuals. Research published over the last several years says absolutely not. Those are hopes, but they're not supported by the research. It's true that if you have very, very low levels of secretin or vitamin B6, then giving some will help with mental functioning. But in general, that's not the underlying issue here for autism. Attention deficit hyperactivity disorder is next. Attention deficit hyperactivity disorder is relatively common. 10% of lower class males, 5% of middle class males. I keep saying males because here is a 10-to-1 male to female ratio, much more common in men. Now, the real issue here is correct diagnosis and making sure you're doing correct treatment. We think that we over-treat and over-diagnose ADHD. You have to separate out ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, from simply active children. Some children just have high energy levels. When we're talking about hyperactive children, we're talking about children that have difficulty paying attention, difficulty sitting still, they have a hard time concentrating, they're fidgeting on an ongoing basis, so much so they're not only disruptive to self, but they're disruptive to other people around them in the classroom. We treat these children that have difficulty holding themselves still with methylphenidate, dextroamphetamine, Pemolin, in other words, with speed. Now wait a minute. They have difficulty staying still, and so we're giving them amphetamines. Right. If you understand the most likely mechanism, this should make all kinds of sense. Think with me. Haven't you ever sat there in class trying to pay attention? You're working hard to stay awake, but it's a long day and it's hard to really pay attention. And so you wiggle your foot, you tap your pencil, you pull in your ear, you twist your hair. These are also called self-stimulating behaviors, increasing your sensory input to keep you awake, okay? Suppose you were really in danger of falling asleep. Suppose you were really in danger of, might have to get up and go running around the room, right? All that activity in order to help keep yourself awake. Well, we believe that that's the underlying difficulty for the ADHD child. And so giving them amphetamines, frankly, helps to keep them awake so they don't have to do it behaviorally. If you've diagnosed your child as ADHD, your patient as ADHD, and you put them on amphetamines, and now as you observe them over the next several weeks, they don't slow down, but in fact they speed up, what do you know? You know you missed the diagnosis. If you're giving an hyperactive child amphetamines, they should slow down. If not, you have one of those overactive children that we often misdiagnose. Understand, the exact diagnosis of ADHD can be very difficult. We usually get teachers' reports, not really physicians' observation for this diagnosis. And teachers have a tendency to report anybody who is disruptive as having ADHD.